This is the first of 3 half-hour parts of an audio recording of a 4-person expert panel discussing end-of-life issues. The discussion took place at Congregation Netivot Shalom in Berkeley, California on August 29th, 2010.
First of all, welcome. It's so wonderful seeing so many people here. This is a panel that had its genesis about 6 months ago, and when we started thinking about it. It's a very important subject. And as you can tell by the latest increase, I think, in news reports, in articles in the media about end-of-life issues, fortunately, it's a subject that is getting more and more discussed in the American culture. And one of the main purposes of today's program is to permit people to talk about the end of life and dying, because normally it seems like a foreboding subject and people don't want to talk about it. In fact, we had a debate among our panelists ourselves whether I could use death in the name of the panel, and we decided end of life issues was intimidating enough, so I'm glad you all were brave enough to come out to do that. Okay, so the other goal that we want to try to get across today is that there isn't one right way to do it. Everybody lives different lives and everybody dies differently, and that's the point we also want to get across, that there's no one right way to do it. Since we are short for time, and this is a very complex subject, we are requesting that you hold back your questions until the end. And that's why I put out the suggested reading list, and you can make some notes on the back. If you have questions as we go along, please put your questions, write them down so you won't forget them. And at the end, we promise we will have time to answer the questions.
While I have everybody's attention, this is the last panel after 5 years, the last 6 years, that Art has organized for us last Sunday morning. I mean, he's still working on it, but he has done it single-handedly for 6 years, twice a month, amazing teachings, prayer, meals. And while everybody's still here, I really want to make sure he gets a really good thank you.
Thank you. I have to say it's been a real pleasure, but the biggest pleasure is having so many of you coming out to hear so many of our members. We've only had one or two repeats. Everybody else who's been here has been a member for the last 6 years, and that's true of our panelists today. It's a wonderful program, and I'm really pleased to introduce Toby Hopstone. Would you please stand up, Toby? Toby is our new chairperson. I'm really pleased that we've been able to put together such a wonderful panel today and that they have agreed to spend their time to prepare and to deliver this program today. I hope you took time to read their bio, because it's very impressive, and I'm going to repeat some of it here. I'm going to go in the order I've got it, even though they're seated in a different order. Dr. Jeff Burek. Jeff, wave your hand, please. Okay. I think you kind of recognize he's the only male on the panel. Medical Director of the East Bay AIDS Center. He's Chair of the Ethics Committee at Alta Bay Summit Medical Center for how many years, Jeff, have you done that?
8 or 9 years.
8 or 9 years. And he is a practicing AIDS physician for over 20 years. Our next panelist is Chaplain Nicole Bloom. Nicole is the Jewish chaplain of Alta Bates Summit Medical Center, and she's been doing that for the past 9 years. And on this end, Professor Joanna Weinberg. Joanna is a teacher of law and health policy at UCSF and at Hastings Law School. She's also a member of the Alta Bates Ethics Committee at Alta Bates Summit Medical Center, and she has lectured and conducted studies about advanced medical directives and durable powers of attorney. I'm also hoping you're kind of putting these people in mind, so at the end, if we don't have time for your questions, you can come up afterwards and ask your own particular questions to these people. And last, not least, of course, is Allison Jordan, who's a registered nurse and has a master's in family therapy. And she's formerly an oncology nurse, and she practices psychotherapy primarily with people facing threatening illnesses. She's particularly interested in Jewish responses to illness, death, and loss, and teaches, consults, and writes about such topics as the deathbed confessional, Vidui. She's helped Rabbi Kalman edit some of those books for our congregation. And please join me in welcoming them and give them your rapt attention. Thank you.
Thank you, Art. I think I can speak for the other panelists, first of all, and say that we're grateful to Art for inviting us to do this and for all of you for being here. Also a little intimidated by the technology that's confronting us that we didn't expect this morning. But, maybe we'll broadcast to the world beyond this way and perhaps get some comments from there toward the end. Along those lines, if you we're planning to leave time, of course, is a topic on which people have a lot to say and a lot of questions, and we are planning to leave some time for those at the end of the discussion, but I want to make sure that the panelists get some time to share their thoughts first. We've done some talking and arguing, as you can imagine, about this topic over the last few weeks. So please, if you think of questions or things that you'd like to say, please jot them down so that you then don't have to worry about remembering it. And we'll get to them later on. I want to start out by telling a story from the Talmud. This is a story that's been told in many different versions about the death of Rabbi Yehuda or Judah Hanasi or Judah the Prince, who was the compiler of the Mishnah. And many of you know this story. I'm going to read the actual version or translation of the version from the Talmud. Rabbi Judah was suffering from a severe and painful stomach disease. His devoted students and colleagues decreed a public fast and offered prayers for heavenly mercy. Furthermore, they announced that whoever said that Rabbi Judah was dead would be stabbed with a sword. The rabbi's handmaid ascended the roof and prayed. And here's what she said. The immortal beings in heaven desire Rabbi to join them, and the mortals desire Rabbi to remain with them. May it be the will of God that the mortals may overpower the immortals. In other words, she's hoping that the prayers of the disciples to keep Rabbi Judah alive will prevail. When, however, she saw how often Rabbi Judah resorted to the privy, painfully taking off his tefillin and putting them on again each time, she prayed, may it be the will of the Almighty that the immortals may overpower the mortals. Watching the rabbis incessantly continuing their prayers for heavenly mercy, she took up an earthenware jar and threw it down from the roof to the ground. For a moment, the disciples ceased praying, and the soul of Rabbi Judah departed to its eternal rest. There's a great deal in this story, and this one simple story raises a number of issues that we thought we'd like to talk a little bit about today. What strikes me immediately on reading this as a physician is that Rabbi Judah's disciples are much like a modern medical team, and their prayers are the equivalent of our technology. The ventilator, the feeding tube, the IV antibiotics, they're keeping alive a man who ordinarily would have died from his ailments. And the rabbi's devoted handmaid first supports their heroic efforts to keep him alive, but as she observes his secret suffering, the loss of dignity, the pain that he experiences, she changes her mind and she prays for his release. But the prayers of the disciples are too strong. So finally, she causes this commotion which distracts them. In a sense, she's momentarily turning off the ventilator and allowing Rabbi Judah to die. We're approaching Yom Kippur, which is seen in Jewish tradition as a rehearsal for our own deaths. We wear white kittel, sometimes the very one in which we plan to be buried. We don't eat all day, which for a Jew, what could be more like death? We recite the vidui, which most of us associate as a Yom Kippur prayer. Thanks. But was primarily intended to be our deathbed confessional. We don't hear about it in the story, but presumably Rabbi Judah recited the vidui at some point in this process, just as we will do in 3 weeks' time. So it seemed like this month of Elul was an opportune time to think about and maybe to share some practical advice about how we and our loved ones together make this final journey. What the handmaid goes through in the story also encapsulates a lot of the dilemmas that we face when we think about end of life and particularly end of life care today. When does the suffering that a person's enduring make prolonging life no longer worth it? How do you know when it's time to change direction? As Art asked when he was first putting this panel together, how do you know when enough is enough? And who has the right to make such decisions? The other thing I just want to comment on about the handmaid's thinking and the changes in her thinking before I turn to the other panelists is how it highlights, how it parallels some of our own attitudes and changes in our own attitudes towards end-of-life care over the past few decades. And I come at this partly from the point of view of medical ethics decision-making and the sorts of issues that come up as conflicts, often between family members and the care teams caring for their loved ones. Remember that as recently as 50 years ago, we really didn't face these sorts of issues. There wasn't much we could do in the face of overwhelming illness to keep people going. This really changed with the development of mechanical ventilators, which really, although they were existed in rudimentary form before that, really became available in the 1950s, followed by kidney dialysis machines in the 1960s. And initially the problem was that these machines were actually scarce resources and there weren't enough of them to go around. So committees were set up to decide who should get these technologies. And in many cases they were quite explicit about the fact that their charge was to determine who deserved access to these technologies. As you might imagine, these were referred to in the press as God committees. Some of you may remember this discussion. And what they turned into eventually, they were the forerunners of our current hospital ethics committees. So the ethics committees that, you know, for example, that Joanna and I now serve on, we don't do this anymore, but those committees were initially set up to decide who would get life-saving technology and who wouldn't. So back then, the worry was that if you had a loved one who was seriously ill, they wouldn't get to benefit from these technologies. They'd be kept from them openly, perhaps, but perhaps secretly. Maybe fairly, maybe not. Maybe because of their medical condition, but maybe because they were black or gay or female or Jewish. You know, so the things that people worried about at the time was, how do we make sure, you know, that people had to advocate on behalf of their loved ones to get access to these technologies? At the same time, there was a much broader social movement rebelling against all kinds of authority in public life. Think about civil rights and the women's movement, the Vietnam War, Watergate, and so on. And, you know, the authority of doctors and other people in positions of power to make these sorts of decisions was being challenged. In the 1970s, though, it became apparent that while these medical technologies could sometimes keep our bodies alive, they sometimes did so in ways that many of us wouldn't want. And there are a couple of famous court cases that brought these issues to light, really, and encapsulated these fears. You may recall the cases of Karen Ann Quinlan and Nancy Cruzan. Both of these were young women who had suffered very severe brain injuries and were being kept alive by technological means. And their families actually fought the doctors for the right to discontinue these means of life support. So here now, the pendulum had swung. For the first time, we were seeing families trying to argue that they, on behalf of their loved ones, had a right that they could exercise to stop treatment. And when I first started working on ethics committees in the 1980s, this was the most common conflict that was brought to us. It was a family who wanted to withdraw life support measures while the doctors, for a variety of reasons, wanted to push on. So it was kind of brought to mind Yehuda Hanasi and his spiritual doctors on the one hand versus the handmaid, in some ways representing family members on the other. This was the genesis of the right to die movement, which is sort of a funny name if you think about it. So dying is not really something that we need a right or really want to claim a right to. But what it really is about is taking control back over the dying process from the medical establishment. And that movement, of course, has continued to evolve to this day, manifesting itself in the increasing popularity of hospice care, palliative care, and so on. I'll just make the comment that, interestingly, we've seen the pendulum oftentimes now swing back the other way. Doctors, perhaps under pressure from their institutions to save money, often now complain that the care that they're giving for some patients is futile or wasteful. that there's no point in keeping certain people alive. Whereas now sometimes it's the family, often families from disadvantaged backgrounds who fear discrimination, just like at the beginning, who fear that the doctors are trying to hold back what would be necessary to keep their loved ones alive. So with that kind of historical background, I want to mention a few themes that were brought to the panelists. Of course, there were many things that we thought we could talk about, but the story brought up a few themes that I want to just mention briefly and then turn to the panel to talk about. And the five themes we want to talk about are first, is there a right way or a good way to navigate the dying process? Is there such a thing as a good death? And what might be the consequences or the implications of our society adopting a particular vision of what the good death might be? A second issue is the role of technology. How much does the availability of technology to keep someone alive drive us to do that? A third theme has to do with hope, and what's often cast as the conflict between, on the one hand, hope, and on the other hand, acceptance of reality, but which many of the panelists think about in terms of different meanings of hope toward life's end. Fourth theme has to do with the roles of family members and others in the dying process. So for most people and for most of us, hopefully, this is not a solitary process, and many other people are deeply involved. And then finally, the last topic we wanted to talk about was about decision-making, autonomy, and who exerts control over issues toward the end of life. So first, let's start out with this issue about the good death. There's a Yiddish saying that there are no bad mothers and no good deaths. What would have been a good death for Judah Hanasi? Is there a single type of good death that we ought to strive for, or does the expectation that one should die in a certain way put pressure on us? What if we don't agree with what it means to die well? What if we do, but for whatever reason, we can't make it go that way? There's another Yiddish saying, pardon my Yiddish pronunciation, but Mensch tracht, Gott lacht, right? Man plans and God laughs. There was a recent British survey that found that 70% of people say that they'd prefer to die at home, and only 7% say they'd like to die in the hospital. The reality is almost exactly the opposite. Over 60% die in the hospital, and that's in Britain, and in the United States the numbers are even higher. So what are we doing wrong? If we think we have an idea about what the good death may be like, are we doing something wrong? So with that, I'd like to start with Nicole.
So this question of good death, to me, as a chaplain and also previously working in medical devices as an engineer, different healing approaches and the question of death and the good death, to me, immediately turns me back to what is a good life. And it's not coincidental that in this season of our Yom Kippur and Elul and Teshuvah being highlighted, it's also a teaching in Jewish tradition that we should do tshuva the day before we die. And, of course, the next question the rabbis ask is, well, how do you know when the day before you die is going to be? And so then the answer is, then every day. And the reality that I have seen in my experience with families in acute illness, in hopes for healing, in dying process, in mourning, in all the process of living, is that when they are faced with the questions that fear of what is to come in any of the circumstances, in dying and death and in the cycle of birth as well, that it highlights what is most precious to people and often asks the same questions of what needs to be addressed and healed, what needs to be amended, what reflections of one's life are most guiding in there going forward. And so it often really does come back to relationship with the people in one's life, the loved ones, and with oneself, perhaps with God, and addressing that same pekuach nefesh, that same accounting of one's life that we try and do at least once a year. But I would put forth that it's the single most addressed concern and hope that comes up with these issues. And it also is what, if a relationship or many relationships within a family, whether there's estrangement or whether there's deep understanding and appreciation of one's hopes about how one would live and how one would die, that in large part determines how well the process can go in the hospital and beyond and outside at home and in one's life. And so to bring us back to, well, what is good dying mean, of course it's very individual, and there's circumstance and story that everyone is different, and yet for each of us to reflect on how might we prepare for that in our living and in our relationships. Do you want to say more about
that? Actually, what? Allison, you've had a lot of experience with people going through this and trying to prepare in this way. Can you comment a little on what Nicole just said?
Yeah, I think I agree with what you're talking about, and the kind of thing that comes to me often is the ways in which people feel pressured and confused about the influences of the popular culture of the time, whether it's an idea of a good death, which an individual or family members might be in disagreement about or might not be capable of the model, whether it's technology outstripping ethics. Much of what you talked about in terms of the evolution of things ends up coming back to be difficult and oppressive for individuals and families. So at the bedside or in support groups or in my office, people and family members bring in this tremendous burden of pain and confusion around how to sort out their own needs and voice, especially when when there are differences between, let's say a family members with an individual wishing to prolong life, another one wishing to let go. These kinds of things are really difficult. So my job is really to be able to be hearing the issues here and helping people to discern what their values are and where they need support and where they need advocacy. And that means family members and caregivers whose issues are really profound and very different, as well as the person who's facing dying. I wanted to mention that when I was looking through papers, I found something from 1976 that also talks about how much more we're talking about choices and the beginning of the hospice movement in this country. Things have certainly evolved, but in a way we're still struggling with the same issues, which I think has most to do with helping the medical system and individuals to feel like things are patient-centered or person-centered, family-centered, rather than being driven, as they often are, by economics, changes in cultural values, etc. So I wanted to just read something that I think actually continues to represent what I hear all the time. This is called the Dying Person's Bill of Rights, and I'm hoping that we have things to say that are implications for helping this to be fulfillable. I don't actually know if it's rights here, but it's values, I'd say. And this was actually created by a group of nurses working together on care for terminally ill people. Here's how they say: I have the right to be treated as a living human being until I die. I have the right to maintain a sense of hopefulness, however changing its focus may be. I have the right to be cared for by those who can maintain a sense of hopefulness, however changing this may be. I have the right to express my feelings and emotions about my approaching death in my own way. I have the right to participate in decisions concerning my care. I have the right to expect continuing medical and nursing attention, even though cure goals must be changed to comfort goals. I have the right not to die alone. I have the right to be free from pain. I have the right to have my questions answered honestly. I have the right not to be deceived. I have the right to have help from and for my family in accepting my death. I have the right to die in peace and dignity. I have the right to retain my individuality and not be judged for my decisions, which may be contrary to beliefs of others. I have the right to discuss and enlarge my religious and or spiritual experiences, whatever these may mean to others. I have the right to expect that the sanctity of the human body will be respected after death. I have the right to be cared for by caring, sensitive, knowledgeable people who will attempt to understand my needs and will be able to gain some satisfaction in helping me face my death.
That all sounds great.
Right.
But what it says to me, though, is some of these things may be things that we'd like to have rights to, but that not everybody really wants to exercise, right? So we've seen people who prefer not to talk about some of the issues on that list, prefer not to have their medical situation discussed in great detail with them. In fact, sometimes prefer not to know what's going on. There are also important cultural differences in some cultures, even today. It's considered taboo to talk to a seriously ill person about the fact that their disease is terminal, or to engage them in actual decision making about this. So, you know, along those lines, the question that I'd like to ask all the panelists to address is how do you balance that? How do you make sure to honor people's individuality, even if their preferences are for a different model than what this Bill of Rights seems to reflect? Nicole, I think you wanted to say something about that. No?
Well, I think that it's important to remember that, again, honoring someone's individual right does not make it a requirement of them, that we don't require people to go through the same process. And in fact, we're misguided when we expect that anyone we are caring for, loving, or witnessing is going to go through a process as we might outline it. So I think that giving people the opportunity to determine what is their own both preference and how do they navigate in their own lives is really the most important piece. People ask all the time, as we've had in our highlighted question about what we're doing here today, what do you say to people? And I think the most important thing you do is you show up and you listen to people. It's not about what you're going to say. It's about listening and paying attention to what the person is experiencing and making sure that there's room for whatever they are experiencing and feeling, and then moving from there in a supportive way. And there's not just one person involved in any of these pictures. There's many people, usually. And again, coming back to what are those issues of needing to be determined? Well, it is the decisions in the hospital, technology influenced, and also it is navigating, okay, have you had a conversation with this person yet about, you know, what's facing you right now? Or can you honor this person's wishes that you might extrapolate from what you know of them? Because that's really what we're here to do at this point in time. So, and being able to do that, I want to just come back a moment for the conversations that I was alluding to earlier. In Teshuvah and in reflections in our relationships, there's actually ways to say it pretty clearly, but we're talking about love. Who do you love? What's most sacred in your life? And how do we savor that? That continues throughout every living day, every dying day. And also, is there forgiveness to offer and forgiveness to ask? What healing is still possible? And for what are you grateful? We have practices for this in our lives and in our prayers, but how do we live it out? And how do we live it out even in our choices about our medical care at that particular moment? I want to put forth that being in that time, from my, I know it's not as It's funny to me sometimes to think about having been a person who designed medical devices and then being in chaplain and having how many times I get the question of how did that change occur. And really, for me, it is about being present with whatever is happening and recognizing that there are lots of different miraculous ways that we can have interventions these days and that we can choose and we can accept and receive that. And yet that's not the only question that's facing us. It's also a wider question of, okay, now how do we be with what's actually occurring right now without just trying to change it? And to say that the place of living and dying and also birthing and living, that these are edges of life that I think we really do have the opportunity for glimpsing holy time and holy experience and holy connection. And so I'm just going to keep infusing that part into this conversation as well.
Thank you.